so? Nevia returned with Clara. The young girl entered the room with blazing cheeks and blackened nails. She had been outside helping the gardener plant dahlia bulbs, and just this once, her clairvoyant faculties had failed her, leaving her unprepared to meet her visitor in a more suitable attire. When he saw her, Esteban jumped to his feet in astonishment. He recalled her as a thin, asthmatic child without the least grace, but the young woman who stood before him was a delicate ivory medallion, with a sweet face and a mane of chestnut hair whose curls spilled from her coiffure, melancholy eyes that gave her a sparkling, half-mocking look when she laughed her frank, open laugh, her head gently thrown back. She greeted him with a strong handshake that showed no trace of shyness. "I was expecting you," she said simply. They spent a few hours in this formal visit, speaking of the opera season, trips to Europe, the political situation, and the winter chills, while they drank sweet wine and ate puff pastries. Esteban watched Clara with all the discretion he could muster, feeling himself gradually coming under the young girl's spell. He could not recall being this interested in anyone since the glorious day when he had first set eyes on Rosa the Beautiful, buying licorice in the pastry shop on the Plaza de Armas. He compared the two sisters in his mind and concluded that Clara had the advantage when it came to charm, although there was no doubt that Rosa had been far more beautiful. Night fell, and two maids came in to draw the curtains and light the lamps. Esteban realized that his visit had gone on too long. His manners left a great deal to be desired. He said a stiff good night to Severo and Nevia, and asked permission to visit Clara again.
"I hope I don't bore you, Clara," he said, blushing. "I'm a simple countryman, and I'm at least 15 years older than you. I don't know how to act with a young girl like yourself."
"Do you want to marry me?" Clara asked, and he noticed an ironic gleam in her hazel eyes.
"My God, Clara!" exclaimed her mother, horrified. "Forgive her, Esteban. The child's always been impertinent."
"I want to know, Mama. I don't want to waste my time," Clara said.
"I also like things to be direct," Esteban smiled happily. "Yes, Clara. That's why I came."
Clara took him by the arm and accompanied him to the gate. In the final glance they exchanged, Esteban understood that she had accepted him. He was overcome with happiness. As he got into his carriage, he was smiling, unable to believe his good fortune and not understanding how such a charming girl as Clara could have accepted his proposal without even being acquainted with him. He did not know that she had seen her own destiny, that she had summoned him with the power of her thought, and that she had already made up her mind to marry without love. Out of respect for Esteban Trueba's mourning, they waited a few months, during which he courted Clara the old-fashioned way, just as he had done with her sister, Rosa, without knowing that Clara hated licorice and that acrostics made her laugh. At the end of the year, around Christmas time, they officially announced their engagement in the newspaper and exchanged rings in the presence of their closest friends, more than 100 altogether, at the Pantagruelian banquet that was an endless parade of stuffed turkey, sugar-cured pork, freshwater eel, lobster au gratin, raw oysters, the Carmelite nuns' special orange and lemon pies, the Dominicans' walnut and almond torts, the Clarissas' chocolate and cream cakes, and cases of French champagne that were brought courtesy of the consul, which took advantage of his diplomatic privileges to traffic in contraband. All was served and presented with the utmost simplicity by the old servants of the house, who wore their everyday black aprons to give the celebration the appearance of a simple family gathering, because any display of extravagance was a sign of vulgarity that would be condemned as a sin of vanity and bad taste, according to the austere and somewhat lugubrious ancestry of that society, descended from hard-working Basque and Spanish immigrants. Clara was a vision in white chantilly lace and natural camellias, as happy as a parrot after her 9 years of silence,
dancing with her fiancé beneath the canopies and lanterns, completely oblivious to the warnings of the spirits that gestured desperately at her from the curtains, because in the tumult and whirl, she could not see them. The ceremony of rings had remained unchanged ever since colonial times. At 10 o'clock at night, one of the men servants circulated among the guests, ringing a tiny glass bell. The music stopped, and the guests gathered in the main hall where a small, innocent priest, adorned with the vestments of high mass, read the complicated sermon he had written, exalting confused and impractical virtues. Clara did not listen to him, because when the din of the music had died down and the whirl of the dancers had subsided, she began to pay attention to the whispering spirits behind the curtains, and she realized that it had been hours since she had last seen Barrabás. She looked everywhere for him, summoning all her senses, but her mother's elbow in her ribs brought her back to the pressing matter of the ceremony. The priest finished his speech and blessed the two gold rings. Esteban quickly put one on his bride-to-be and slipped the other on his own finger. At that moment, a scream of horror shook the guests. The crowd cleared to either side, making a path for Barrabás, who staggered out blacker and larger than ever, with a butcher's knife stuck in his back, clear to the hilt, bleeding to death like an ox, his long colt legs trembling, his muzzle dripping with threads of blood, his eyes clouded in agony. Dragging one paw after the other, he traced the zigzag path of a wounded dinosaur. Clara fell back onto the French silk love seat. The enormous dog approached her, laid his huge millennial animal head on her lap, and looked up at her with lovesick eyes that gradually dimmed and grew blind, while the white chantilly lace, the French silk of the sofa, the Persian carpet, and the parquet floor absorbed his blood. Barrabás was dying without any hurry, his eyes riveted on Clara, who stroked his ears and murmured words of comfort until finally, with a single rattle, the dog fell rigid at her feet. Suddenly, it was as if they had all been wakened from a nightmare, and the sounds of panic spread through the room. The guests hurriedly said goodbye, stepping over the pools of blood and quickly gathering up their fur stoles, their top hats, their canes, their umbrellas, and their beaded evening bags. The only ones left in the parlor were Clara, with the animal on her lap, her parents, who were locked in terrified embrace at the thought of such an evil omen, and her fiancé, who could not comprehend such an uproar over a dead dog. But when he realized that Clara was transfixed, he picked her up in his arms and carried her half-conscious to her room, where Nana's ministrations and Dr. Cuevas's pills prevented her from falling back into her stupor and her muteness. Esteban Trueba asked the gardener to help him, and between the two of them, they threw Barrabás's body into the car. Death had made him so heavy that it was nearly impossible to lift him. The following year was spent preparing for the wedding. Nivea took charge of Clara's trousseau, since Clara did not show the slightest interest in the contents of the sandalwood trunks, and continued her experiments with the three-legged table and her divining cards. The sheets so carefully embroidered, the linen tablecloths, and the underwear the nuns had sewn 10 years ago for Rosa, with the intertwined initials of Trueba and Del Valle, were now part of Clara's trousseau. Nivea ordered clothes from Buenos Aires, London, and Paris, travel dresses, country dresses, party dresses, stylish hats, matching shoes and purses of lizard and suede, and various assorted other things, which remained in their tissue paper wrappings, preserved with lavender and camphor, without the young brides ever giving them so much as one distracted look. Esteban Trueba took charge of a team of bricklayers, carpenters, and plumbers, who were engaged to construct the largest, sunniest, and sturdiest house imaginable, built to last 1,000 years and lodge several generations of a bountiful family of legitimate Truebas. He hired a French architect and had part of the building materials imported from abroad, so that this would be the only house with German stained glass windows, moldings carved in Austria, faucets of English bronze, Italian marble floors, and special locks ordered by catalog from the United States, which arrived with the wrong instructions and no keys. Ferula, horrified by the expense, tried to keep him from additional folly, from buying French furniture, teardrop chandeliers, and Turkish carpets, by arguing that this would quickly be their ruin, and that they would find themselves repeating the story of the extravagant Trueba who had sired them. But Esteban countered that he was rich enough to give himself these luxuries, and threatened to line the doors with silver if she went on bothering him. She replied that such wastefulness was certainly a mortal sin, and that God would punish all of them for spending on nouveau riche vulgarities what they should be giving to the poor. Despite the fact that Esteban Trueba was no great lover of innovation, and had, in fact, a deep mistrust for the dislocations of modernity, he decided that his house should be constructed like the new palaces of North America and Europe, with all the comforts but retaining a classical style. He wanted it to be as far removed as possible from the native architecture. He would hear nothing of three courtyards, corridors, rusty fountains, dark rooms, walls of whitewashed adobe, or dusty tiles on the roof. He wanted two or three heroic floors, rows of white columns, and a majestic staircase that would make a half turn on itself and wind up in a hall of white marble, enormous, well-lit windows, and the overall appearance of order and peace, beauty and civilization that was typical of foreign peoples and would be in tune with his new life. His house would be the reflection of himself, his family, and the prestige he planned to give the surname that his father had stained. He wanted the splendor to be visible from the street, and so he designed a French garden with topiaries fit for Versailles, deep wells of flowers, a smooth and perfect lawn, jets of water, and several statues of the gods of Olympus, and perhaps one or two courageous Indians from the history of the Americas, naked and crowned with feathers, his one concession to patriotism. He could hardly guess that the solemn, cubic, dense, pompous house, which sat like a hat amid its green and geometric surroundings, would end up full of protuberances and incrustations, of twisted staircases that led to empty spaces, of turrets, of small windows that could not be opened, doors hanging in midair, crooked hallways, and portholes that linked the living quarters so that people could communicate during the siesta, all of which were Clara's inspiration. Every time a new guest arrived, she would have another room built in another part of the house, and if the spirits told her that there was a hidden treasure or an unburied body in the foundation, she would have a wall knocked down until the mansion was transformed into an enchanted labyrinth that was impossible to clean and that defied any number of state and city laws. But when Trueba built the house that everybody called the Big House on the Corner, it bore the stately seal with which he managed to stamp everything around him, as if in memory of his childhood privations. Clara never went to see the house during the time it was being built. She was as uninterested in it as she was in her trousseau, and she left all decisions in the hands of her fiancé and her future sister-in-law. When her mother died, Ferula found herself alone and with no useful purpose to her life, at an age when she could no longer hope to marry. For a time, she made daily visits to the slums as part of a frenzied charitable activity, which gave her chronic bronchitis and brought no peace to her tormented soul. Esteban wanted her to take a trip, buy herself some clothes, and enjoy herself for the first time in her melancholy life. But she already had the habit of austerity and had spent too much time cooped up in her house. She was afraid of everything. Her brother's marriage plunged her into uncertainty, because she feared that this would be yet another reason for Esteban to keep his distance, and he was her only comfort and support. She was afraid of ending her days crocheting in some nursing home for spinsters from good families. Thus, She was overjoyed to learn that Clara was incompetent when it came to the simplest domestic tasks, and that whenever she had to make a decision, she became distracted and vague. "She's a bit on the stupid side," Ferula concluded with delight. It was clear that Clara would be incapable of administering the mansion her brother was constructing, and that she would need a lot of help. As subtly as she could, she made it known to Esteban that his future wife was completely helpless, and that she, with her proven spirit of self-sacrifice, could help her out and was ready to do so. Esteban could never follow her conversations when they took this sort of turn. As the wedding date approached and she realized she would have to decide her own fate, Ferula grew desperate. Convinced that her brother would never give her a clear answer, she waited for an opportunity to speak alone with Clara. She found it one Saturday afternoon at 5 o'clock, when she saw her walking down the street. She invited her to the Hotel Francais for tea. The two women sat surrounded by cream puffs and Bavarian porcelain, while in the back of the tea room, an all-female ensemble played a melancholy string quartet. Ferula quietly observed her future sister-in-law, who looked about 15 and whose voice was still off-key as a result of all her years of silence, not knowing how to broach the subject. After a seemingly endless pause, in which they ate a tray full of pastries and drank 2 cups of jasmine tea apiece, Clara straightened a wisp of hair that had fallen across her eyes, smiled, and gave a gentle tap to Ferula's hand. "Don't worry," she said. "You're going to live with us, and the two of us will be just like sisters." Ferula was startled. She wondered if the rumors about Clara's talent for reading minds were true. Her first reaction was pride, and she would have refused the offer just because of the beauty of the gesture. But Clara did not give her time. She leaned across and kissed her on the cheek with such candor that Ferula lost control and began to cry. It had been a long time since she had shed even a single tear, and she was astonished to see how badly she had needed some sign of tenderness. She could not remember the last time anyone had spontaneously touched her. She wept for a long time, unburdening herself of many past sorrows and her loneliness, still holding onto Clara's hand. Clara helped her blow her nose, and between sobs, fed her forkfuls of pastry and sips of tea. They wept and talked until 8 o'clock at night, and that afternoon in the Hotel Francais, they sealed a pact of friendship that would last for many years. As soon as the period of mourning for Doña Esther was over and the big house on the corner was finished, Esteban Trueba and Clara del Valle were married in a modest ceremony. Esteban gave his wife a set of diamond jewelry, which she thought beautiful. She packed it away in a shoebox and quickly forgot where she had put it. They spent their honeymoon in Italy, and 2 days after, they were on the boat. Esteban was as madly in love as an adolescent, despite the fact that the movement of the ship made Clara uncontrollably ill and the tight quarters gave her asthma. Seated by her side in the narrow cabin, pressing cold compresses to her forehead and holding her while she vomited, he felt profoundly happy and desired her with unjust intensity, considering the wretched state to which she was reduced. On the 4th day at sea, she woke up feeling better, and they went back out on deck to look at the sea. Seeing her with her wind-reddened nose and laughing at the slightest provocation, Esteban swore that sooner or later she would come to love him as he needed to be loved, even if it meant he had to resort to extreme measures. He realized that Clara did not belong to him, and that if she continued living in a world of apparitions, three-legged tables that moved of their own volition, and cards that spelled out the future, she probably never would. Clara's impudent and nonchalant sensuality was also not enough for him. He wanted far more than her body. He wanted control over that undefined and luminous material that lay within her and that escaped him even in those moments when she appeared to be dying of pleasure. His hands felt very heavy, his feet very big, his voice very hard, his beard very scratchy, and his habits of rape and whoring very deeply ingrained. But even if he had to turn himself inside out like a glove, he was prepared to do everything in his power to seduce her. They returned from their honeymoon 3 months later. Ferula was waiting for them in their new house, which still smelled of paint and fresh cement, and was filled with flowers and platters heaped with fruit, just as Esteban had ordered. When they stepped across the threshold for the first time, Esteban lifted his wife in his arms. His sister was surprised not to feel jealousy, and observed that Esteban looked rejuvenated. "Getting married has done you a world of good," she said. She showed Clara around the house. Clara ran her eyes over everything and found it all quite lovely, just as she had politely approved of a sunset on the high seas, the Piazza San Marco, and her diamond jewelry. When they came to the door of the room that was to be her own, Esteban asked her to shut her eyes and let her into it by the hand. "You can open them now," he said. Clara looked around. It was a large room with walls papered in blue silk, with English furniture, big windows and balconies that opened onto the garden, and a canopied bed with gauze curtains that looked like a sailboat on a sea of calm blue silken water. "Very lovely," Clara said. Then Esteban pointed to the place where Clara was standing. It was a special surprise he had prepared for her. Clara looked down and gave a frightful cry. She was standing on the black back of Barrabás, who lay there split down the middle, transformed into a rug. His head was still intact, and his two glass eyes stared up at her with the helpless look that is a specialty of taxidermists. Her husband managed to catch her before she fell to the floor in a dead faint. "I told you she wasn't going to like it," said Ferula. Barrabás's tanned hide was quickly removed from the bedroom and shoved in a corner of the basement, along with the magic books from Uncle Marcos's enchanted trunks and other treasures, where it resisted moths and neglect with a tenacity worthy of a better cause, until it was rescued by subsequent generations. It soon became evident that Clara was pregnant. Ferula's affection for her sister-in-law became a passion, a dedication to waiting on her and caring for her, and an unlimited tolerance for her distractions and eccentricities. For Ferula, who had spent her life taking care of an old lady who was slowly, irremediably rotting alive, looking after Clara was like being in heaven. She bathed her in jasmine and basil water, rubbed her with cologne, powdered her with a swan's down puff, and brushed her hair until it was as soft and shiny as an underwater plant, just as Nana had done before. Long before his newlywed impatience had died down, Esteban Trueba was forced to return to Tres Marias, where he had not set foot for more than a year, and where, despite the vigilance of Pedro Segundo Garcia, its owner's absence was sorely felt. The property, which had once seemed to him like paradise and had been his pride and joy, was now a nuisance. As he watched the expressionless cows chewing their cuds, the sluggish labors of the peasants repeating the same motions day after day throughout their lives, the unchanging background of the snowy cordillera, and the frail column of smoke rising from the volcano, he felt like a prisoner. While he was in the countryside, life in the big house on the corner changed, making way for a gentle routine without men. Ferula was the first out of bed in the morning, because she was still in the habit of rising early from the days when she watched over her invalid mother, but she let her sister-in-law sleep late. In mid-morning, she personally served her breakfast in bed, threw open the blue silk curtains to let the sun in, and filled the French porcelain bathtub that was painted with sea nymphs, giving Clara time to shake off her sleep as she greeted one by one the spirits in the room, brought the tray up to her chest, and dipped her toast in the thick hot chocolate. Then Ferula drew her out of bed with a mother's gentle caresses, telling her the good news from the morning paper, which was less every day, so that she was forced to fill the gaps with gossip about the neighbors, domestic trivia, and made-up anecdotes that Clara found very lovely and forgot within 5 minutes. Thus, Férula could tell the same ones over and over, and Clara always enjoyed herself just as if it were the first time she was hearing them. Férula took her strolling in the sun, because it was good for the baby, shopping, so the child would lack for nothing when it was born, and have the finest clothing in the world. For lunch at the golf club, so everyone would see how beautiful you have become since marrying my brother. To see her parents, so they don't think you've forgotten them. And to the theater, so you don't spend the whole day shut inside the house. Clara let herself be shepherded around with a sweetness that was not stupidity, but distraction. And she devoted all her powers of concentration to vain attempts to communicate with Esteban by telepathy. Her messages did not arrive, and to perfecting her abilities as a clairvoyant. For the first time she could remember, Férula felt happy. She was closer to Clara than she had ever been to anyone, even her own mother. Someone less original than Clara would have tired of her sister-in-law's excessive pampering and constant worry, or have succumbed to her domineering and meticulous nature. But Clara lived in another world. Férula abhorred the moment when her brother returned from the country and filled the house with his presence, breaking the harmony they had established while he was away. When he was in the house, she had to disappear into the shadows and be more prudent in the way she addressed the servants, as well as in the care she lavished on Clara. Every night, when the married couple retired to their rooms, she was overwhelmed by a peculiar hatred she could not explain, which filled her soul with regret. To take her mind off things, she reverted to her old habit of saying the rosary in the slums and confessing her sins to Father Antonio. "Hail Mary, full of grace, conceived without sin. I hear you, my child."
"Father, I don't know how to say this. I think I committed a sin."
"Of the flesh, my child?"
"My flesh is withered, Father, but not my spirit. The devil is tormenting me."
"The mercy of the Lord is infinite."
"You don't know the thoughts that can run through the mind of a single woman, Father. A virgin who has never been with a man, not for any lack of opportunities, but because God sent my mother a protracted illness and I had to be her nurse."
"That sacrifice is recorded in heaven, my child."
"Even if I sinned in my thoughts?"
"Well, it depends on your thoughts."
"I can't sleep at night. I feel as if I'm choking. I get up and walk around the garden, and then I walk inside the house. I go to my sister-in-law's room and put my ear to her door. Sometimes I tiptoe in and watch her while she sleeps. She looks like an angel. I want to climb into bed with her and feel the warmth of her skin and her gentle breathing."
"Pray, my child. Prayer helps."
"Wait, I'm not finished. I'm ashamed."
"You shouldn't be ashamed with me. I'm just an instrument of God."
"When my brother's back from the country, it's even worse, Father. My prayers are useless. I can't sleep. I sweat. I shake. And finally I get up and walk through the whole dark house, gliding down the corridors as carefully as possible so they don't squeak. I listen to them through their bedroom door. And once I even saw them, because the door had been left ajar. I can't tell you what I saw, Father, but it must be a terrible sin. It's not Clara's fault, I know, because she's as innocent as a little child. It's my brother who leads her into it. I know he's damned."
"Only God can judge and damn, my child. What were they doing?" Férula could spend half an hour on the details. She was a gifted narrator who knew exactly where to pause, how to measure her cadence, how to explain without too many gestures, painting a scene so true to life that her listener felt as if he were there. It was incredible how she could sense from the half-open door the quality of their trembling, the abundance of juices, the words whispered in the ear, the most secret smells, a veritable miracle. She unburdened herself of these agitated states of mind, returned to the house with her idol's mask, impassive and severe, and resumed giving orders. Put this here, and it was done. Change the flowers in the vases, and they were changed. Wash the windows. Hush those damn birds. Their noise won't let Señora Clara sleep. And all that cackling is going to frighten the baby. And who knows but it might be born with wings. Nothing escaped her watchful eye. She was always moving, unlike Clara, who found everything so lovely and who was as happy to eat truffles as she was to have leftover soup, to sleep in a feather bed as to sleep sitting up in a chair, or to bathe in scented water as to not bathe at all. As her pregnancy advanced, she seemed to be distractedly letting go of reality and turning inward in a secret, unceasing conversation with her baby. Esteban wanted a son who would bear his name and pass his family name on down the generations.
"It's a little girl, and her name is Blanca," Clara had said when she announced that she was pregnant.
And so it was. Dr. Cuevas, whom Clara no longer feared, calculated that the birth would be sometime around the middle of October, but it was already the beginning of November, and Clara was still swinging her enormous belly around, in a state of semi-somnambulance, ever more distracted, more exhausted, more asthmatic, indifferent to everything around her, even her husband. From time to time, she didn't recognize him and would ask, "May I help you?" when she noticed him standing by her side. Once the doctor had ruled out the possibility of a miscalculation in the date, and it was evident to all that Clara had not the slightest intention of giving birth the normal way, he proceeded to open her belly and extract little Blanca, who proved to be an uglier, hairier child than usual. Esteban jumped when he saw her, convinced that destiny was playing a cruel joke on him, and that instead of the legitimate treba he had promised his mother on her deathbed, he had sired a monster, and a female one to boot. He personally examined the child and verified that she had all the necessary parts in their correct locations, at least those that could be seen with the naked eye. Dr. Cuevas consoled him by explaining that the child's repulsive appearance was due to the fact that she had spent a longer time than usual in her mother's body, to the effects of the Caesarean, and to her own small, thin, dark, and somewhat hairy constitution. Clara, on the other hand, was delighted with her daughter. She seemed to have wakened from a protracted stupor and discovered the joy of being alive. She took the child in her arms and would not let her go. She went everywhere with her little girl, clutched to her breast, nursing her constantly without a set schedule, and without regard for manners or modesty, like an Indian. She did not want to swaddle her, cut her hair, pierce her ears, or hire a nursemaid to take care of her, and least of all to use milk manufactured in some laboratory, as all the ladies did who could afford such luxuries. Nor would she accept Nana's prescription for giving her cow's milk diluted with rice water, because, she said, if nature had wanted human beings to be raised on that, she would have made women's breast capable of secreting it. Clara spoke to the child all the time, not in baby talk, but in perfect Spanish, as if she were conversing with a grown-up, the same way she addressed plants and animals. She was convinced that if she had had such good results with flora and fauna, there was no reason why it should not work with her own child. The combination of mother's milk and conversation transformed Blanca into a healthy, almost pretty child who bore no resemblance at all to the armadillo she had been at birth. A few weeks after Blanca's birth, Esteban Trueba was able to confirm, thanks to her lively kicks aboard the sailboat on the blue silk sea, that maternity had not diminished his wife's enthusiasm for making love. Just the opposite. And Férula, too busy in caring for the child, who had formidable lungs and impulsive nature and a voracious appetite, had no time to say the rosary in the slums or attend confession with Father Antonio, much less to peek through the half-open door. 4. The Time of the Spirits. At an age when most children are still in diapers, Blanca looked like an intelligent midget. She stumbled when she walked, but she kept her balance and she spoke correctly and fed herself, all because her mother treated her like an adult. She had all her teeth and was just beginning to open the big wardrobes and wreak havoc on their contents when the family decided to spend the summer at Tres Marias, a place Clara had only heard about. At that moment in Blanca's life, her curiosity was stronger than her instinct for survival, and Férula was constantly chasing the child up and down the hall, afraid she would fall from the second story, stick her head in the oven, or swallow a bar of soap. The idea of taking the child to the country seemed risky, exhausting, and unnecessary, since Esteban could do everything he needed to do by himself at Tres Marias while she and Clara enjoyed their civilized existence in the capital. But Clara was enthusiastic. To her, the country was a romantic idea, because she had never been inside a stable, as Férula put it. The preparations for the trip kept the family busy for 2 weeks, and the house became a clutter of trunks, steamer baskets, and valises. They hired a special car on the train to accommodate the unbelievable amount of baggage and servants Férula thought they needed, not to mention the birds in their cages, which Clara could not leave behind, and Blanca's toy chests, which were filled with mechanical clowns, porcelain figurines, stuffed animals, wind-up dancers, and dolls with real human hair and movable joints, who traveled with their own clothing, carriages, and china dishes. At the sight of that disorganized, nervous crowd and that pandemonium of belongings, Esteban felt defeated for the first time in his life, especially when he discovered, in the midst of all the baggage, a life-size statue of St. Anthony, cross-eyed and wearing embossed sandals. He stared at the surrounding chaos and regretted his decision to travel with his wife and daughter, wondering how it could be possible that he had only packed 2 bags for his foray into the outside world when they had amassed a carload of dishes and a parade of servants that had nothing to do with the purpose of the trip. At San Lucas, they took 3 carriages, which conveyed them to Tres Marias in a cloud of dust, like a bunch of gypsies. Waiting for them in the courtyard of the hacienda were all the tenants, under orders from the foreman, Pedro Segundo Garcia. They were speechless at the sight of this traveling circus. At Férula's bidding, they began to unload the carriages and take the things into the house. No one noticed a little boy of about Blanca's age, who was standing there with a runny nose, his naked belly swollen with parasites. He had a pair of beautiful black eyes that looked out at the world with an old man's gaze. He was the foreman's son, and, to differentiate him from his father and grandfather, he had been named Pedro Tercero Garcia. In the tumult of getting settled, exploring the house, snooping around the orchard, greeting everyone, setting up the altar of St. Anthony, and shooing the chickens from the beds and the mice from the closets, Blanca pulled off her clothes and ran out naked to play with Pedro Tercero. They played among the packages, hid beneath the furniture, exchanged wet kisses, chewed the same bread, ate the same snot, and smeared themselves with the same filth until, wrapped in each other's arms, they finally fell asleep under the dining room table. Clara found them at 10 o'clock at night. Everyone had spent hours looking for them with torches. Teams of tenants had gone up and down the riverbanks, the granaries, the fields, and the stables searching for them. And Férula had got down on her knees before the altar of St. Anthony. Esteban was hoarse from calling their names, and Clara had vainly tried to summon her ability to read the future. When they found them, the little boy was on his back on the floor, and Blanca was curled up with her head on the round belly of her new friend. Many years later, they would be found in the same position, and a whole lifetime would not be long enough for their atonement. From the very first day, Clara understood that there was a place for her in Tres Marias, and just as she recorded it in her notebooks, she felt that she had finally discovered her mission in life. She was not impressed by the brick houses, the school, and the abundant food, because her ability to see what was invisible immediately detected the workers' resentment, fear, and distrust, and the almost imperceptible noise that quieted whenever she turned her head enabled her to guess certain things about her husband's character and past. Still, the patron had changed. Everyone could appreciate that he had stopped going to the Red Lantern. His nights on the town, his cockfights, his gambling, his violent tantrums, and, above all, his bad habit of tumbling girls in the wheat fields were a thing of the past. This they attributed to Clara, and Clara, too, had changed. From one day to the next, her listlessness had vanished. She had stopped finding everything so lovely, and she seemed to have been cured of her habit of speaking with invisible spirits and moving the furniture by supernatural means. She rose at dawn with her husband and ate breakfast with him already dressed. Then, while he went out to supervise the work in the fields, Férula took charge of the housework. The servants from the city, who could not adjust to the discomforts of the country and the flies, and Blanca. Clara divided her time between the sewing workshop, the general store, and the school, where she established her headquarters for treating mange and lice, untangling the mysteries of the alphabet, teaching the children to sing, "I have a dairy cow, she's not just any cow," and the women to boil milk, cure diarrhea, and bleach clothes. At sundown, before the men came in from the fields, Férula gathered all the peasant women and children to say the rosary. They came more out of kindness than faith, giving the aging spinster a chance to recall her good old days in the tenements. Clara waited for her sister-in-law to finish the mystical litanies of Our Fathers and Hail Marys, then used the meetings to repeat the slogans she had heard her mother shout when she chained herself to the gates of Congress. The women listened with embarrassed smiles, for the same reason they prayed with Férula, so as not to displease the patron's wife. But those inflammatory cries only made them laugh. Since when has a man not beaten his wife? If he doesn't beat her, it's either because he doesn't love her or because he isn't a real man. Since when is a man's paycheck or the fruit of the earth or what the chickens lay shared between them? When everybody knows he is the one in charge. Since when has a woman ever done the same things as a man? Besides, she was born with a wound between her legs and without balls, right, Señora Clara? They would say. Clara was beside herself. The women nudged each other in the ribs and smiled shyly with their toothless mouths and their wrinkled eyes, their skin toughened by the sun and their unhealthy lives, knowing full well that if they took it into their heads to put Clara's ideas into practice, their husbands would beat them. And deservedly, to be sure, as Férula herself declared. Esteban soon found out about the second half of their prayer meeting and became enraged. It was the first time he had ever been angry with Clara, and the first time she saw him have one of his famous tantrums. He shouted like a madman, pacing up and down the living room and slamming his fist against the furniture, arguing that if Clara intended to follow in her mother's footsteps, she was going to come face to face with a real man who would pull her pants down and give her a good spanking so she'd get it out of her damned head to go around haranguing people, and that he categorically forbade her to go to prayer meetings or any other kind, and that he wasn't some ninny whose wife could go around making a fool of him. Clara let him scream his head off and bang on the furniture until he was exhausted. Then, inattentive as ever, she asked him if he knew how to wiggle his ears. The vacation grew longer, and the meetings in the schoolhouse continued. Summer came to an end, and autumn covered the fields with fire and gold, changing the landscape. The first cold days arrived with their rain and mud, but Clara did not show the least sign of wanting to return to the city, despite a sustained campaign on the part of Férula, who hated the countryside. During the summer, She had complained about the stifling evenings, which she spent shooing flies, about the dust clouds in the courtyard, which covered the house as if they were living in a mine shaft, about the dirty water in the bathtub, where her special perfume salts became a Chinese soup, about the flying cockroaches that got between the sheets, about the burrows of mice and ants, about the half-drowned spiders she found kicking in the glass of water on her night table each morning, about the insolent hens who laid their eggs in her shoes and shat on the lingerie in her dresser. When the weather changed, she had new calamities to complain about. The mud in the courtyard, the abbreviated days. It was dark at 5 and there was nothing to do but face the long, solitary night. The wind and the winter colds, which she countered with eucalyptus plasters that were powerless to keep the family from infecting each other in an endless chain. She was tired of struggling against the elements with nothing to break the monotony but watching Blanca grow. The child looked like a cannibal, she said, playing with that dirty little boy, Pedro III. And worst of all, the child had no one of her own class to mix with. She was picking up bad manners and went around with flushed cheeks and scabs on her knees. Look how she talks. She sounds like an Indian. I'm tired of pulling lice out of her hair and putting blue methylene on her mange. Despite her muttering, she maintained her rigid dignity, her unchanged bun, her starched blouse, and the ring of keys that hung from her waist. She never perspired, never scratched herself, and always kept her faint scent of lavender and lemon. No one thought that anything could undermine her self-control, until one day she felt an itching on her back. It was such a strong itch that she could not refrain from discreetly scratching it, but nothing gave her any relief. Finally, she went into the bathroom and took off her corset, which she always wore, even on the days when she had a lot of work. As she loosened the stays, a dazed mouse, which had spent the entire morning vainly trying to find an exit between the hard points of the corset and the oppressed flesh of its owner, fell to the floor. Férula had the first attack of nerves in her life. Everyone came running at her cries and found her standing in the tub, livid with terror and still half undressed, screaming like a maniac and pointing with her shaking finger at the tiny rodent, who was struggling to his feet and attempting to make his way to a safer place. Esteban said it was menopause and that there was nothing anyone could do. They paid no more attention when she had the second spell. It was Esteban's birthday, and that Sunday morning dawned as sunny as anyone could want. There was a great commotion in the house because there was going to be a party in Tres Marias for the first time since the forgotten days when Doña Esther was a girl. They invited various relatives and friends who took the train out from the city and all the landed gentry from the neighborhood without overlooking the town notables. A week before the party, they prepared the banquet. Half a steer roasted in the courtyard, kidney pie, chicken casserole, various corn dishes, egg fruit, and the best harvest wines. At noon, the guests began to arrive by coach and horse, and the great adobe house filled with laughter and conversation. Férula excused herself for a moment and ran to the bathroom, one of those immense bathrooms where the toilet was placed in the middle of the room, surrounded by a vast desert of white tiles. She was ensconced on that throne-like solitary seat when the door opened and in walked one of the guests, no less a personage than the mayor of the town, already unbuttoning his fly and slightly tipsy from his aperitif. When he saw the lady, he became paralyzed with confusion and surprise, and by the time he was able to react, the only thing he could think of was to walk toward her with a twisted smile, crossing the entire room and extending his hand. Sorebabel Blanco Jamasmie, pleased to meet you, he introduced himself.
For God's sake, it's impossible to live among such uncouth people. If the rest of you want to stay in this uncivilized purgatory, that's your prerogative, but I'm returning to the city. I want to live like a human being the way I always have. Férula exclaimed when she was able to speak of the incident without bursting into tears.
But she did not leave. She did not want to be separated from Clara. She had come to adore the very air Clara exhaled, and even though she no longer had occasion to give her baths and sleep in the same bed with her, she found a thousand ways to express her tender feelings, and to this she dedicated her existence. That woman who was so hard on herself and others could be so sweet and smiling with Clara, and at times, by extension, with Blanca. Only with Clara did she allow herself the luxury of giving in to her overwhelming desire to serve and be loved. With her, however slyly, she was able to express the secret, most delicate yearnings of her soul. The long years of solitude and unhappiness had distilled her emotions and purified her feelings down to a few terrible, magnificent passions, which possessed her totally. She had no gift for small perturbations, mean-spirited resentments, concealed envies, works of charity, faded endearments, ordinary friendly politeness, or day-to-day acts of kindness. She was one of those people who are born for the greatness of a single love, for exaggerated hatred, for apocalyptic vengeance, and for the most sublime forms of heroism. But she was unable to shape her fate to the dimensions of her amorous vocation. So it was lived out as something flat and gray, trapped between her mother's sick room walls, wretched tenements, and the tortured confessions with which this large, opulent, hot-blooded woman, made for maternity, abundance, action, and ardor, was consuming herself. She was about 45 years old then, and her splendid breeding and distant Moorish ancestors kept her looking fit and polished, with black, silky hair and a single white lock on her forehead, a strong and slender body, and the resolute step of the healthy. Still, the emptiness of her life made her look far older than she was. I have a photograph of Ferula taken around that time, on one of Blanca's birthdays. It is an old, sepia-toned picture, discolored with age, but you can still see how she looked. She was a regal matron, but with a bitter smile on her face that revealed her inner tragedy. Those years with Clara were probably the only happy period in her life, because only with Clara could she be herself. Clara was the one in whom she confided her most subtle feelings, and to her she consecrated her enormous capacity for sacrifice and veneration. She once was bold enough to tell her how she felt, and Clara wrote in her notebook that Ferula loved her far more deeply than she deserved or than she could ever hope to repay. Because of that excessive love, Ferula did not want to leave Tres Marias, not even after the plague of ants, which began with a humming in the pastures and quickly became a dark shadow that glided everywhere, devouring everything in its path, the corn, the wheat, the alfalfa, and the marigolds. The ants were sprinkled with gasoline and set on fire, but they reappeared, invigorated. The tree trunks were painted with quicklime, but the ants continued to climb, sparing neither pears, oranges, nor apples. They went into the garden and ate their way through the cantaloupes. They entered the dairy, and at dawn the milk was sour and full of minuscule cadavers. They got into the chicken coops and ate the chickens alive, leaving behind a whirl of feathers and a pile of pathetic little bones. They cut paths right through the house, tunneled through the pipes, took over the pantry. Everything that was cooked had to be eaten immediately, because if it was left on the table for even a few minutes, they arrived in a procession and gobbled it up. Pedro Segundo Garcia fought them with fire and water and buried sponges soaked in honey so that it would attract them all to the same place, where he could kill them by surprise, but it was all in vain. Esteban Trueba went into town and returned weighed down with pesticides in every form known to man, powders, liquids, and pills, which he sprayed and sprinkled everywhere. No one could eat any vegetables because they would get stomach cramps, but the ants continued to appear and multiply, daily growing more impudent and more decisive. Esteban went back into town and sent a telegram to the city. 3 days later, Mr. Brown, a tiny gringo, arrived at the train station clutching a mysterious suitcase. Esteban introduced him as an agricultural technician specializing in insecticides. After cooling off with a glass of wine with fruit in it, he opened his suitcase on the table. He removed a whole arsenal of tools that none of them had ever seen before and proceeded to trap an ant and carefully observe it with his microscope.
"What are you looking for, mister? They're all the same," said Pedro Segundo Garcia.
The gringo did not answer him. When he had finished identifying the species, its lifestyle, the location of its burrows, its habits, and even its most secret desires, a whole week had passed, and the ants were beginning to crawl into the children's beds, had finished off the winter food reserve, and were starting to attack the cows and horses. So Mr. Brown explained that they would have to be sprayed with one of his special products, which would make the males of the species sterile. Thus, they would cease to reproduce. Then they had to be sprinkled with still another poison, also of his own invention, which would bring about a fatal illness in the females, and that, he promised, would put an end to the whole problem.
"How long will it take?"
asked Esteban Trueba, whose patience was giving way to fury.
"1 month," said Mr. Brown.
"By that time, they'll have eaten all the people, Mr. Brown," said Pedro Segundo Garcia.
"If you'll allow me, patron, I'm going to call in my father. For the past 3 weeks, he's been telling me he has a cure for plagues. I'm sure it's just one of those old people's tales, but there's no harm trying."
They brought in old Pedro Garcia, who shuffled in looking so dark, small, and toothless that Esteban was surprised at this sign of time's relentless passage. The old man listened with his hat in his hand, looking down at the ground and chewing the air with his empty gums. Then he asked for a white handkerchief, which Férula brought from Esteban's wardrobe, and went outside. He crossed through the courtyard and entered the orchard, followed by all the inhabitants of the house as well as the foreign midget, who was smiling scornfully. "These poor savages, oh God!" The old man squatted down with difficulty and began to collect ants. When he had a fistful, he put them in the handkerchief, knotted his four corners, and placed the little bundle in his hat.
"I'm going to show you the way out, ants, so you get out of here and take the rest of them with you."
The old man climbed up onto a horse and ambled slowly, mumbling advice and recommendations, prayers of wisdom and enchanted formulas to the ants. The others saw him disappearing off the edge of the property. The gringo sat down on the ground and laughed like a madman, until Pedro Segundo Garcia grabbed him and shook him.
"Go laugh at your grandmother, mister. That old man is my father," he warned.
Pedro Garcia returned at dusk. He slowly dismounted, told the patron that he had led the ants to the edge of the highway, and went into his house. He was tired. The next morning, there were no ants in the kitchen, none in the pantry, the granary, the stable, the chicken coops, the pastures. The family and the tenants went all the way to the river, checking everywhere along the way, and found not a single ant, not even one to use as a sample. The expert was furious.
"You have to show me how to do that," he shouted.
"By talking to them, mister. Tell them to go, that they're a nuisance here.
They understand," explained old Pedro Garcia.
Clara was the only one to whom the procedure seemed completely normal. Férula latched onto it as proof that they were living in a hole, an inhuman region in which neither God's laws nor scientific progress seemed to have made inroads, and that any day now they were all going to be traveling by broom. But Esteban Trueba told her to be still, because he did not want anyone putting any new ideas into his wife's head. In the past few days, Clara had reverted to her visionary tasks, speaking with apparitions and spending hours writing in her notebooks. When she lost all interest in the schoolhouse, the sewing workshop, and the women's meetings, and once again found everything ever so lovely,
They knew she was pregnant again.
And it's your fault,
Ferula shouted at her brother.
I hope so, he replied.
It was soon evident that